You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at opensocietyfoundations.org.
Thank you all for coming. I'm Steve Hubble from the Open Society Fellowship Program. I'm delighted to welcome Open Society Fellow Tim Wise to our offices. I met Tim in Asmara, I think in April of 1993. When Eritrea was just becoming independent. I'd been familiar with his journalism, his reportage. I knew of his work as executive director of Grassroots International. I've not seen you for 20 years until just a few months ago. Tim is now the research director at the Global Development and Environment Institute at Tufts University. He's now a couple of months advanced in his fellowship work. One of the things that excited us about your fellowship was the potential for your work to align in interesting and unpredictable ways with the work of our Global Shared Framework on Food Security in the Wake of Climate Change in Africa. Sometimes it's ironic that in an organization founded by one of the most subtle and sophisticated interpreters of markets anywhere in the world, we sometimes lack an equally sophisticated understanding of how markets operate, in this case commodities markets, and specifically with regard to maize and the global trade in maize. Thank you all for coming, and over to you, Tim.
Yeah, thank you all for coming. Very nice to finally get down here to meet more than just the fellowship team and to connect on the what I'm doing and get a better sense of how that connects and feeds into the shared framework on food security and climate change and how that can feed back, because that's very much what I'm looking at out there in the big bad world. What I thought I'd do here is just kind of run through what the basic framework is for this project and then a little bit what I've been doing and seeing and reporting on, and as much as anything just to give you the background to spend more of the time answering your questions and getting your comments. I've certainly enjoyed the fellowship so far. It's taken me in 4 months in order, I think, to Mexico, Rome, Des Moines, Iowa, South Africa, Bali for the World Trade Organization meetings, and most recently Geneva, Addis Ababa for the AU Summit on Agriculture, and Malawi. It's hard to imagine I could keep that pace up for the rest of the year, but it's been wonderful. The Malawi piece is really the first kind of the first part of this that's going straight at the questions of the fellowship. Impacts food security and climate change in Africa in the context of the integration of global fuel, food, and financial markets. How does that all fit together, particularly in maize-producing Africa and maize-consuming Africa? So I'll try to run through in 20 minutes or so what I have here. If it's too quick, just ask a question, and it will undoubtedly be too quick, because I'll try to leave more time for your questions and comments. This all started, in a way, with my work on the food crisis, that is, the food price spikes of 2007 and 8, and what really changed the game in agricultural policy, agricultural development policy, in terms of, at least at the rhetorical level, at the policy level. So there were suddenly the questions were back on the table that hadn't been asked for a long time. How much should countries grow their own food? How was there a problem to depend too much on imports? And the implication in it all was that there had been a structural change in agriculture, and that this was the sign of the structural change. We'd gone from extensive surpluses in the global north being exported to the south, no problem, cheap food, to the end of surplus, to scarcity related to climate change. So is that a structural change? And has public policy in any way been responsible for letting the genie out of the bottle on that and causing this somewhat unhealthy connection between food and fuel and financial markets? And if so, can public policy help put the genie back in that bottle, or at least make it behave more responsibly in the world? We also did a report related to this on assessing all these estimates that we're not going to be able to feed the world in 2050. And, you know, it's really a Malthusian story. At least the alarms are, they call for a need for double food production by 2050. It implies that you need to modernize agriculture and go straight into industrial agriculture and leave smallholders by the side of the road. But what's really changed, and how real are those Malthusian threats? I think that in general we concluded that the situation is not as bad as most people say, yet at the same time it's worse, which is a very comforting conclusion, I'm sure. But what we mean by that is that the alarmism is unwarranted, in that the actual predictions that have been made by the FAO and others are not the doubling of food production. It's a 60% increase in agricultural production. So that includes cotton, it includes biofuels, not food. So, and that, according to FAO projections, we can do it at current productivity levels, and you know, it implies a lot. But the reason it could be worse is that they don't adequately take into account biofuels and climate change. Very hard to model this stuff in these long-term models, and they really don't capture it well. They underestimate it. So both of those issues vary on the side of needing to produce more. So they could be also underestimating. And then the financialization of food, as it's been called, the issue of financial speculation on commodities markets, is also not really incorporated. So the huge volatility in prices and what that means. But all of these represent structural changes, and then the question is, what can you do about it? At least from a policy perspective, the hypothesis is that they can be weakened or reversed through public policy, since they were brought on by public policy. So two prices, the quick primer on the food price crisis. Food prices 1990 to 2012, you'll see very stable and then relatively low prices into the early 2000s, and then a kind of steady rise in the underlying food price with two spikes. The two spikes were what got called the food price crisis, but the steady rise was real too. And some see the steady rise, the underlying rise in the bottom trend as related to supply and demand, and the spikes as related to financial speculation. But I'll talk more about that later. In any case, the point for developing countries and food importing countries is that food prices doubled, basically. That reversed a trend, this is from the previous 25 years, of generally downward food prices. And so that's why people point to a structural change. The impact on least developed countries, and I just came back from Malawi, which certainly qualifies as one of those, is soaring food import bills. They went from being the dotted line is their exports, the solid line is their imports as a group, and in the mid-80s they shifted from being a small net exporter to a massive net importer now. Imports now at nearly $27 billion and trade deficits at $17.5 billion. And again, I saw the effects of that in Malawi that I'll talk about. That's largely because structural adjustment programs, financial, fiscal arrangements, changes in government policies reduced the investment in domestic agriculture in a lot of the least developed countries, on the theory you could import the food you needed cheap on the international market. That was relatively true for a long time, but it's clearly not true now.
Can I just ask a question? Yep. Is that an explicit piece of advice that was coming from the bank and other kind of development experts who were actually also controlling their financial flows and their access to development aid?
I mean, it's the basic comparative advantage argument.
Yeah.
In other words, we grow corn cheap.
Yeah.
why do you need to grow corn? You can buy it from us cheap. You should do fill in the blank that you can do more effectively. I mean, the difficulty being that in a place like Malawi, it's not clear what they can do more effectively that they could export. The result, and just because I've done a lot of work on Latin America, I pulled this example, is a rising import dependence, in this case for corn. And so you see in Central America as a whole, it went from under 20% to nearly 50% of corn came from mostly the U.S. in this case, and in Guatemala from about 10% to about 40%. So that's a generalized trend that you also see in Africa. The oddity about it, and the thing that from an economic development standpoint is, I think, underappreciated, is that if you look at those two lines for consumption and production for Central America, the red lines. So consumption is demand, right? So that's the internal demand in Central America for corn. Production is completely stagnant, and instead of having the demand for corn feed the market for domestic corn, the demand for corn is feeding the demand for imports. And so the question from a development standpoint is, why can't countries capture that demand as a stimulus to their own domestic food production? And again, I will come back to Malawi, but that's what I saw them trying to do in Malawi. Okay, the brief primer on the structural changes in global agriculture. There's a lot written on this, and actually I found the people in South Africa have, mostly when I talk about this in the United States, people go, oh, food, fuel, finance, really, they're linked, how? And in some of the colleagues I met in South Africa, they're like, oh, you mean the triple F? It's like, they're there. I mean, they've been talking about it for a while, and that was really interesting to see. But essentially what you're looking at is there's always been a connection, an increasing connection between food and fuel prices, just because food is dependent on chemical inputs that are rely on petroleum-based products. There's transportation involved, et cetera, et cetera. That's changed and gotten more intense, and this graph I think shows that the red is the oil price and the blue is the food price, and you can see that the spikes are following each other, the trends are much more closely related, and that's even more in the context of climate change. In part, that connection is more intense because of the rise in biofuels production. This is global biofuels production of all kinds. Biofuels quite directly links the price of fuel to the price of food. A lot of it's using the same crops, like corn, and a lot of it is using, and it's all using the same land. So the demand for land, even if it's not corn-based ethanol, but it's sugar, even if it's jatropha trees, it's still demanding land, and that's making land scarce, and that's pushing prices up for anything that you need the land to produce. So that dramatic rise, and most people don't appreciate just how recent and sudden that was. I mean, you look at that trend, it's really since 2005, and it's really the product of U.S. policy. In the U.S., that was corn-based incentives to corn ethanol, the renewable fuel standard, subsidy, a blender tax credit for using ethanol, a 10% mandate to use it in gasoline, a tariff protecting the ethanol industry from U.S. from Brazilian corn and ethanol imports. The only thing that's left of that, this is good news, is the renewable fuel standard, but that's still a significant driver of demand, and the oil price is a significant driver of demand. If oil prices are high, ethanol looks like a good deal, right? It's fairly simple, but that directly ties corn markets to petroleum markets in an unhealthy way for food production. This is the ethanol share of U.S. corn production. Again, how dramatic it is. It went from about 10% of U.S. production all the way up to 40%. And just to appreciate, that's 40% of U.S. corn is 15% of the global corn supply. We are the largest corn producer, largest corn exporter in the world. And so what we do affects global markets, and what the ethanol policy did has affected global markets. Again, it's not projected to get better. This is projections through 2021. That's not all corn ethanol. Most of that is actually sugar, which is a different story. It's not a direct food crop, a staple food crop, and it has different implications for the environment. But still, the implications for the land are similar, and the question is whether that's is that really a good thing for the climate? How good a thing is it for the climate? So you're dealing with the climate issue with this biofuels policies. And then what are the costs of that to food markets? Then there's the financial speculation piece. And this really links both food and fuel into one big unhappy derivative. If this, I don't much like this graph. I'm going to find a new one for it in the course of this fellowship. But let me just explain it very briefly. This is, the size of the circle is the amount of money in the futures markets. So again, the first circle is in 2000. So again, you're looking at a sudden and meteoric rise. It rises most when the financial crisis hits in the United States because money, speculative money, flowed out of those markets and into commodities, which were considered safe. Within those circles, the blue is the traditional hedgers. That's the people who have an interest in the actual physical commodity, the people who are the Petroleum Association of New England, who's buying oil futures to guarantee their access during the winter months, the corn producer who's taking a futures sale so that he gets a guaranteed price in the after harvest. Now, the green are the traditional speculators, and those are people who have always been in these markets but have been generally overshadowed by the actual traditional hedgers, those with a physical interest. But the red is the index speculators. That's people who bundled their money into commodity index funds. And commodity index funds are essentially a weighted listing of futures market investments that notably have many food crops in them, but most importantly have fuel crops at the top of them. And so fuel crops dominate, and again, it creates a structural link between fuel and food prices. When oil prices go up, the value of those goes up as well and drags the food price up as well. So it creates the speculative, that's where people feel the speculative bubble is most clearly seen. Finally, as we all know, greenhouse gas emissions come significantly from forestry and agriculture. According to this way of measuring, about 31%. There are others who calculate that it's probably more like 51% if you count all the throughput costs of agriculture and food, including processing and the rest. So from a mitigation standpoint, it's huge. And from an adaptation standpoint to climate change, it's absolutely essential, and I'll talk about that looking at Malawi. This was one of the more stark representations that people gave of this trend, where some interesting systems modelers in Cambridge came up with a model that was just kind of astonishingly close to these food price trends. The dotted line is what they say, what I called earlier, the underlying trend upward in food prices from supply and demand, and the spikes they attributed to speculation. And again, the model fit very well. I mean, I think there's some issues with this study, but that's their underlying food price increase due only to corn ethanol. So they say corn ethanol in the U.S. is the problem. So again, interesting from this perspective that I'm taking on the role of corn markets in global food security. shifting a little bit to Africa, the interesting thing is the prices here transmit even to maize exporting countries, and this is Uganda, and the food price spikes again, where the red line is the global maize price, the blue line is the Uganda retail maize price, and this shows a pattern that I'm going to argue with a lot of people about. In the course of this project, in fact, on the plane to Malawi, I ended up sitting next to a guy who did the study that said this wasn't true. So, go figure. It's a small Malawi's a small country. But people look at this. Some economists look at this graph and say there's no correlation between these prices, and I look at this graph and say there's an absolute correlation between the upward spikes in these prices. You notice that with a short time lag, the red upward slopes transmit to the blue in both cases of the price spikes. And then, unfortunately for Uganda, they stay high. And economists have a name for this. It's called prices being sticky high. And it means that it usually means that speculators on local markets are there and can manipulate prices, knowing that there's a scarcity and a fear about shortages. So it's actually worse than prices transmitting, right? It means that the price transmits and it goes up locally, even if you're a net exporter of maize, and then they stay high. So from a food security perspective, it's actually not comforting that the prices don't transmit completely. It's actually worse. So that's one of the stories yet to tell and yet to look into. But for a place like Uganda, 65% of their income is spent on food and 20% of urban calories come from purchased maize. So you're talking about big food security impacts. So can you put the genies back in their bottles? Well, that's really one of the key questions for me in this project. Biofuels and financial speculation were created by policies, and they can be weakened by policies in the sense that financial speculation came from the deregulation of financial markets in the early 2000s. And, you know, a lot of the Dodd-Frank regulations are intended to try to tamp down the amount of speculative capital going into food commodities. Some of those are very good reforms if they're allowed to be implemented. If they're not litigated away by the financial industry, then that could make a difference, and we could see that weakened. Biofuels is driven significantly by these mandates, and it's at this point, countries all over the world are putting in place these mandates. So that's a challenge. U.S. corn ethanol program is one of the most obvious problems here. But underlying it all is the need to invest in developing country food production, whether you believe you can put these genies back in their bottles or not, because if you're dependent on these international markets that see huge volatility and high prices, you're paying way too much for your imports, and you have no idea how much you're going to need to pay year to year for your imports, and how you're going to insulate your population against high prices. And then with climate change in the mix, you have a need for both mitigation and adaptation. And for poor countries like Malawi, the adaptation piece is critical. It's like they are already experiencing climate change, and all over the world, but notably in some of the poorest parts of the world, they're already experiencing climate change in the form of shorter rainy seasons. That's their whole agricultural, that's their food security base is that rainy season, and it's gotten much more unreliable. So, what am I doing? basically, documenting those U.S. policy distortions, and I call them policy distortions because from an economic perspective, they are distorting global markets. Biofuels, financial speculation, and U.S. agricultural and trade policies. Hopefully, you won't ask me too much about the new farm bill, but because that'll be a piece of the story. But it's really to identify how those impacts, those policies are rippling out of the United States and into developing country markets and impacting food security. In Malawi, the government has invested in a maize self-sufficiency program, and it's shown the limits of sort of the high-input fertilizer-based model. So what are they going to do? That's what I just came back from on Thursday looking at. In Tanzania, land acquisitions, otherwise known as land grabs by some people, are driven significantly by global biofuel demand. So if you can decrease the demand, you can decrease the impacts on land tenure and food security. But how are countries dealing with those pressures, right? That's the question. So I'll look at that in Tanzania. In Uganda, the price volatility I showed in the context of climate change, and then African governments have made a very strong commitment to increase their spending on agricultural development, which is noteworthy, impressive, lagging behind what they committed to, but very significant. And their citizen-based efforts, very interesting citizen-based efforts to better direct government investment, to monitor how ag budgets are spent, and to intervene, to lobby for both cleaner government, right? So there's a clean government piece of that. And there's huge corruption in a lot of these ag policies. They just are designed for that, particularly in Malawi. But there's also a need to lobby for how that money gets directed. Is it going to be directed to large-scale industrial agriculture? Is it going to be directed to smallholders? If it's directed to smallholders, is it going to be all trying to get everyone doing high-input seeds and fertilizers and the rest? Or is it going to be what people sometimes call climate-smart agriculture, climate-resilient agriculture with lower inputs and less dependence? And then finally, Mexico, where I've done a lot of work, is really looking at the false promise of genetically modified maize in the center of origin for maize, sort of the agrobiodiversity risks that are inherent in that, and then also the just the whole question of, you know, if the point is to for Mexico to grow more of its own maize, well, they can do that. They don't need genetically modified maize to do it. But that whole, it relates to the larger question of what's become the model for agricultural development in the developing world, which is public-private partnerships as a way to get to leverage, in theory, to leverage private capital into agricultural development projects that are government-driven. That's the idea. And that can bring the technology, the know-how, the expertise, and the capital to bear on these efforts. Again, there's a lot of controversy about that in the region. I've written a lot already. Like I said, you guys have already sent me all over the world. Well, not all over the world, but to a lot of the world, which has been great. So I put the link down there, which Steve certainly has. We created a fellowship page at my research institute just so that there would be one place where publications and interviews and things like that were are collected. So if you want to, you know, we can put you on our list to get notified when new things come out. Just give me your email and I can do that. Or you could collect emails and send them to us and we'll do that. What makes this project particularly exciting for me, and I hope it's exciting for you all too, is that these issues really are front and center, right? When I went to the World Trade Organization meetings in Bali, it wasn't obvious before that the Indian food security program was going to be the topic of debate, the issue that hung out, that threatened to derail an agreement there. But it was. Now, what is the Indian food security program? It's a commitment by the government to buy grain from farmers, small farmers, at a slightly supported price, a guaranteed price, and distribute it to poor Indians in a program that's destined to reach 65% of Indian people with food distributions. And the U.S. objected to it on the grounds that it was an illegal subsidy under WTO rules. There's an arcane way of calculating it that I won't go into. But it put the issue right at the center of the agenda, and that food security law in India was the product of probably the world's most advanced right-to-food campaign in the world. The Indian right-to-food movement is astonishing. It's a grassroots movement of sort of coming really trying to empower, use the right to food as something that can be enacted in legislation, and it has been, upheld by courts, and in India it has been, and used then by citizens to demand progressive realization of the right to food. That's what the right to food means in the world. That has interesting, that's an interesting new wrinkle in the last, again, in the last 5 years, that makes this, makes the entry of those concerned with rights into this discussion very important. It really is resonating around the world, that approach. And I saw it in Malawi, where there's a Malawian Right to Food Network as well. So on to Malawi very briefly. So here's what Malawi's really looking at smallholders and the right to food, because they only have smallholders, basically, and they almost only grow food. They actually almost only grow maize, which is one of their problems. I was there during the rainy season. They're experiencing climate change in a serious way. The rains usually start in late October. They start later, they end earlier, they're erratic. That's the main experience they have of them. This year they didn't start till mid-December, so that's a month and a half late. That's serious for this country. They were good rains while it was raining, as you can tell by the lush landscape here. This does not look like a country that is starving or that has had famines, but it is a country that has 1.8 million people now in serious food security straits out of 18 million people, and that has experienced famine in its recent past. But the government has invested heavily in maize production. It's, stealing Michael Pollan's term, it's the cornification of, he talked about the cornification of our diets in the United States, but it's the cornification of Malawi and much of corn-producing Africa. Did you know that Ethiopia now produces, its largest grain crop is maize? It's astonishing. But this is what high-input agriculture knows how to do, is maize. They don't know how to do teff in Ethiopia. And the Alliance for a Green Revolution in Africa is all about, well, it's about a lot of things, but it's significantly about improved seeds, more fertilizer, and getting those into the hands of smallholders and larger farmers, preferably more larger farmers than smallholders, and ramping up food production. So there's huge incentives to grow corn. And you see this in Malawi, because Malawi adopted a fertilizer input subsidy program against the advice of the World Bank. They became famous because they, even though donors give them 40% of their government budget, they said no to the donors and said, we don't care if you don't think we should be using input subsidies. We're going to use them because we're not going to have another famine. And it worked. They grew a lot more corn. They actually grew enough corn that they declared themselves self-sufficient in corn for a year or two. I mean, they have good and bad rains. And they even exported some corn. So everyone kind of acknowledges that that worked. And it's kind of broken down the resistance to such programs in interesting ways. But it's shown the limitations of that high-input model, because it's incredibly expensive. So what's happened to you if you've decided, we're not going to import any more corn, we can't afford it, we need to grow more of our own food, and so you start using a lot of fertilizer to grow more corn yourself? What are you importing? Fertilizer. You are not actually creating a huge level of independence from international markets, and you've actually tied yourself more closely to fuel markets, because fertilizer is most heavily dependent on fuel. So that's the big contradiction of it all. So the question is sort of, one of the questions I looked at and got a lot of insights into is whether improved seeds and the fertilizers that you need to make them work are a savior or a dependency trap. And I visited Monsanto in Malawi, which was very interesting. They control about 50% of the seed production in in Malawi, and I kept asking people, you know, how much for small farmers who can't always afford all the fertilizer, how much better are these seeds? Like, are the yields that much better? And everyone said they're better, but they're only a little better. And they have to buy the seeds every year, so that's a cost, but it's subsidized by the government. But that means the government's subsidizing seed companies, right, the purchase for seed companies, so that's tricky. And then they're subsidizing the fertilizer, which if you don't use it, the hybrid seeds don't do too well, right? So the very interesting thing that came on my last day in Malawi, so really this was Wednesday of last week, sitting in the ag minister's office, and I was asking him these questions, like, well, you have these seeds that the government developed that are open pollinated, which means you can replant them year to year, and they don't do much worse than these hybrid seeds, and they're much more tolerant of inconsistent fertilizer application, so, and of inconsistent rains. So aren't they a better risk? You know, why would you do that? And he said, well, when we were forced to privatize some of our national industries in the 1990s under a structural adjustment program from the World Bank and the IMF, we privatized the national seed company. And Monsanto bought it. So you have Monsanto, with an interest in selling its own seeds, essentially capturing all of the intellectual property that had been generated by years of innovation by the Malawian government, public investment, not patented, not anything, tweaking those varieties, making them hybrids, and marketing them through the government subsidy program, favored by the subsidy program, because again, the donors intervened, USAID in particular intervened and said, the government shouldn't be the ones distributing the seeds, the private sector should distribute the seeds. Monsanto's share went up to about 75% of the government seed distribution. And suddenly you have this, what I think is the beginnings of a dependency trap, where you lose the native seeds, partly because companies are shelving them and not reproducing them, so they don't remain a choice, and partly because the dependency you have on those seeds includes dependency on imported fertilizer. So that's the real interesting dynamic of sort of how this plays out in Malawi with a government that's incredibly committed to increasing its food independence. And the alternative exists right in Malawi too. And including in this fertilizer subsidy program where they distribute seeds, they actually lobbied, the farmers and others lobbied to get legume seeds distributed with maize seeds so that they could be intercropped. And if they're intercropped, they fix nitrogen in the soil. You can see if you look closely, I think you're seeing pigeon peas, which is a local crop, intercrop between the maize plants. They fix nitrogen in the soil and reduce the need for chemical fertilizers and build soil quality. This guy is standing in front of his insanely healthy maize field, which is actually planting a variety of open pollinated orange maize, which I hadn't seen before. There were no cobs, so I couldn't really see the maize yet on this one, but really healthy plants. They're trying to encourage orange maize because of the high vitamin A. And vitamin A is one of the main deficiencies in the diets in a lot of parts of a lot of poor countries. So it's open pollinated, so you can replant it. It does not require, it's tolerant of low levels of chemical fertilizer application. And in his field, he said this was the first year he'd used no fertilizer at all. Again, just from intercropping. He really wasn't doing anything else much more sophisticated than that. So could Malawi do that as a country? And where would that leave them? Fertilizer is the second largest import cost after fuel. So you can't actually get along without fuel, and they have no domestic sources of fuel. That's not one, you know, that's not a discretionary spending item, but fertilizer could be. So that's an that's the other interesting dynamic. Just to close, this is the African Union. I was in its headquarters in Addis before going to Malawi, where the in the spanking new building donated to the African Union by the Chinese government. Those buildings are all over Africa. but this quote, I think, is telling. African countries are not looking forward to depending continuously on external supplies that will remain uncertain in prices and quantities. Actually, our ultimate unquestionable ambition is to develop our agricultural markets. In our opinion, we must rely on our own production to meet our food needs. In fact, importation is not Africa's goal. So that is where their stated commitment is. The question is whether they can really get there. So hope I didn't take too long.
That was, no, thank you, Tim. I sense that there is pent-up demand for more information here. I might start the questioning off. As far as responses are concerned, there exist, as we know, many voluntary guidelines concerning ethical investment practices, sustainable agriculture, et cetera. Are there any that are targeted specifically at undercutting the three Fs, particularly the speculation in commodities like maize, and that have enjoyed any level of success? I mean, what sorts of approaches, if any, along those lines that you've seen, would you think offer the greatest promise?
I mean, there are sustainable biofuels guidelines and codes of conduct. They don't have the best reputation for being sort of a sustainable soy initiative. There's a, you know, you can find initiatives like that. There's a lot of privately generated standards that can be good and are often really bad because they essentially, you know, put a green stamp on a bad practice because people realize that there's a demand for green practices. So I would say not at this highest level of, you know, at the level of the food fuel finance issues. It's very hard to do to do fair trade type stuff in commodity crops. They're just too big and diverse and complicated.
Questions?
Yeah. So I have many questions I could ask, but I'll limit myself to just one. I'm interested to know if in your research and your various trips, have you heard from folks talking about or investigated at all some of the environmental effects? So the two, for example, that you didn't mention were deforestation and how that ties into the lack of land and also contributes to climate change. And also, for example, with all this heavy use of fertilizer, the runoff and how that affects water supply and clean water and things like that. So has, you know, how that affects communities, you know, for their own water supply, for example, and also greater issues of climate change, lack of water, et cetera.
Right. No, that's a really good question. And it's, I'm looking a lot at that. I mean, my institute is called the Global Development and Environment Institute for a reason, and we've looked a lot at those issues in maize. Interestingly, on the fertilizer question, there have been environmental impact studies, ex post environmental impact studies on Malawi's fertilizer distribution program, and they found very few negative environmental impacts from things like runoff, because it's an indicator that they still aren't getting the optimal amount of fertilizer, never mind an excess, because runoff means what's not absorbed.
Right.
So it's really not enough to get into the water supply. And so they're not getting that kind of impact. Land is a huge problem in Malawi. Malawi is the most densely populated country in Africa. And it has the fastest population growth rate, coming on the heels of one of the worst AIDS epidemics. There's an estimated 500,000 AIDS orphans in Malawi. 18,000 people and 500,000 AIDS orphans. It hit Malawi really hard. Heterosexual transmission was huge in ways that surprised people, but it devastated the country about 10 years ago. And but that said, I mean, and related to that is this high growth, high birth rate, which stays high, and a fairly compressed, relatively small land mass, and a fast-growing population. So plots are getting subdivided and subdivided, and that's a huge problem. Deforestation is an issue, but they've done a pretty good job of deforesting already. Unfortunately, you could see in those photos there. I was astonished. I'd never been anywhere where smallholders had food planted absolutely everywhere you looked. In the city, I mean, the city of Lilongwe, the capital city, is planted in maize. Like, the median strips are planted in maize. Everything is maize. And that has environmental issues, actually. The concern, one of the biggest complaints I heard was about urban, what they call urban agriculture. We think of urban agriculture as like, oh, those nice rooftop gardens. It's like, no, we're talking about deforestation of the urban settings and the hillsides, and they have now huge flooding problems in a lot of the cities because of that kind of deforestation. So, Erica.
Thank you for this. First of all, it was really powerful and extremely depressing. but I appreciate it very much. I'm wondering...
I'm not depressed, if that helps you.
That's good. Okay, that's good. I'm wondering... I have a zillion questions, but I guess maybe to sort of limit it to a few. One, is the focus of your work going to be mostly on U.S. policy because U.S. is the big corn producer and that's the lens you're looking through? Or might you also be looking at other major commodities markets, for example, Switzerland, and deregulation in those other markets as well? Mm-hmm. And then the second question is, you mentioned that there's just been huge corruption in the way a lot of this privatization and sort of contracts have happened, and I wonder if you'll be looking into those deals or like anything that might come out of your research in terms of identifying particular entities or actors that might that we might be able to take some action on.
I mean in answer to the first question, it's not just U.S. policy, and it's really not just maize. I mean, I think that's the lens through which this is a really... I'm finding it very useful to not look at the whole world and not look at every crop, but just kind of focus it on this. But that mainly plays out in the form of looking at maize-producing Africa and maize-consuming Africa. And so that links, in a more direct way, those markets to U.S. and Brazilian and Chinese markets, to all global markets. But that's one in which the U.S. policy plays such a decisive factor. I mean, the largest discretionary policy that has contributed to high maize prices is the biofuel program in the United States. So right there, you've got the starting point. I hope to look at the ways, essentially, when I describe this project to people when I was in Malawi, I described it more as how has the new environment in the post-food crisis world playing out in your country? And I'm looking much more at how the national governments are responding to those challenges, because they are. I mean, that's why I don't think you should be so hopeless. Malawi has just made itself maize self-sufficient when it had three serious famines in the last 15 years. And they did it like that. It's like, and they ignored World Bank advice to do it. So what's the good news? They ignored World Bank advice. And they did it. And now it's brought a whole host of other contradictions. But they actually have the solutions right at their fingertips if they can find the political will, the space from the donor pressure and all the rest to do it. Tanzania has a wide range of very creative policies going on. Africa as a whole, it's like, you know, it's like they can't, you know, the whole Comprehensive African Agricultural Development Program, CADAP, is the commitment they made 10 years ago to increase agricultural spending to 10% of budgets, of government budgets, and this is the year of agriculture in Africa, and, you know, a lot of it's rhetoric, but it's not. Citizens are empowered to act on those commitments, and they do. So that's what you see. The right to food movement actually rises in that context. So I think that's all very positive. Your second question was about...
Just about the fact that you identified corruption in these private-public partnerships, and if your research would sort of be identifying particular actors or deals that were...
Maybe. It's a little hard to tell right now. I mean, I'm dying to go back and look at the privatization terms that Monsanto gobbled up the Malawian Seed Company for, just because I really got that news on the last morning of my visit to Malawi and I haven't had a chance to look into it. You know, I think the corruption I was mentioning is actually relates to, you have a fertilizer subsidy program and it's considered now politically untouchable. Because whoever's in power drops coupons for subsidy and for fertilizer and seeds into the hands of voters, with an election coming up in May, and nobody has yet invented a better formula to buy votes than that. And that's what people in Malawi would tell you, which is that a lot of them wish that program didn't exist, but they figure the only way to deal with it is to change it, is to reform it from within. The donors now, a lot of them hate it. So, but they hated it to start with because it went against free market principles. But I do think there are going to be interesting opportunities to look at some of these. I really want to look at the public-private partnership thing. You know, it's all under the framework of the G8's, G8 Nations' new Alliance for Global Food Security and Nutrition. That program, to me, was a huge disappointment because in 2009, the G8 countries made a significant commitment, even in the wake of the financial crisis, to increase their public support for agricultural development in the developing world. The so-called L'Aquila commitments made in L'Aquila, Italy, a three-year commitment of $22 billion, which was a significant increase over previous aid levels, and not just to, you know, to safety net programs, but to productivity programs for agricultural development based on smallholder development. That was new, and that was significant. It came time to renew that in 2012, and unfortunately, President Obama led the charge in declaring the new Alliance for Food Security and Nutrition as a private sector-led initiative that that has signed on to it the largest agribusiness firms in the world, and the idea is really for the public sector. I mean, you know, so that, I guess that Monsanto purchase of the Malawian Seed Company was a public-private partnership in some way. Some of them are, I visited one in Malawi that was great. Malawi mangoes, look for it on your supermarket shelves someday soon. Apparently there, some British investors came in, irrigated a section of land that was irrigable. Started a production of high-quality bananas and mangoes on a plantation, a small plantation, but with commitments and contracts with outgrowers, so with smallholders in the area, technical support to them to become suppliers with a guaranteed price. Their workers seem to be paid decently. Rainforest Alliance certified project. I mean, you can get... Some of the stuff can be really good. But Malawi signed on to the new alliance very recently, and one of the things that happens when you do that is that the government signs an agreement that is really like a contract to make the country safe for private investment. And that involves all kinds of changes, permanent changes in the law that are tricky.
Agree.
So I struggle with this framing of this question, even though we keep trying to do it, and it's should be obvious, but it doesn't seem. I think that we historically, as an organization, to take the example that we've just been talking about, say corruption, we start from the assumption that all corruption is bad, and where we see an opportunity, we might want to get in there and try and do something about it. But you just gave a perfect example of where it might be a really bad idea to make fertilizer-related corruption the target of your effort, because the unintended consequence would be to undermine a good initiative that has changed the game for Malawi's food production. And with that example in mind, what we're struggling with, I think, as we think about what this food security and shared framework is for, is what are the virtuous circles that you could get moving that don't just target one problem, seeds or corruption? And we can see that, and you've just beautifully illustrated, the interconnection between a number of different policy initiatives, which essentially are not necessarily, in fact, often are not responsive to each other. They're being driven by a set of logical propositions that will not lead to a virtuous circle on their own. So, yeah. And we say that OSF has a bunch of different tools. It can do behind-the-scenes government advice and has some leverage in some spaces. It can do out in the front of the palace protest. It can do financial investment. It can a bunch of stuff. So the logical question for an organization like ours is, couldn't we affect two or three different things at once? And applying the simultaneous pressure on those things, start a new virtuous circle working that would actually pay the Malawians not to sign on to that agreement, pay them to nationalize or build a new seed company, pay them to... But I'm just riffing. I don't really know anything about that. I guess what I'm trying to say to you is, how far is your work able to help us tackle that problem, which essentially is a sort of downstream problem for us as we try and figure out what to do with this project?
No, I talked a lot with the OCESA people about that. And actually with Cedric De Beer at the from SADF, we had a really interesting meeting about the about what they were doing, which is in Southern Africa not so much on agriculture. I mean, at this point they're looking at other types of things. So, but whether there are opportunities for things like that in agriculture for SADF is interesting. SEDF, sorry. I mean, this Malawi Mangoes project was interesting in that regard. He talked about a similar project, actually, in, I forget what country it was in. It might have been South Africa.
Where was it, Evgeny?
No, it's the
Ghana.
Was that the sugar? He was talking about a sugar plantation, private investment, sugar plantation with an outgrower scheme that would bring the infrastructure of milling into
rice,
the community.
Rice.
Oh, was that rice?
Yeah.
It wasn't sugar.
Rice.
It was rice, you're right.
Yeah.
Oh, so that's the one thing. Yeah, so that one sounds a lot like the Malawi Mangoes project in a way. And that seems like it has lots of virtuous circles built into it.
But relatively small, in the sense that if we were trying to mobilize not just SEDF but simultaneously SEDF, OSF, George Soros, what's the big thing that we would put all of those three to work on doing separately but in parallel, so that we would reward different behavior? That's the question. And is it hubris anyway? That may be craziness, but I think if we don't ask ourselves that question, I think we can do lots of things which are good in principle and show that our heart is sewn onto our sleeve. But if we really wanted to shift the logic of some of what you're talking about, then what would it be and how would we do that?
Yeah, I don't know that I have that answer.
You don't?
I don't. Not yet. I mean, I'm only 4 months in here. Talk to me in a couple months.
Well, I guess I'm trying to put it on your agenda that's actually what we really, really want out of this process.
That's a really interesting way to put the question, and it's helpful because, I think you guys have put a lot of thought into this shared framework and sort of what so levers of change, which is really what I'm looking at too. How do you put the genies back in the bottle? How do you sort of, for developing countries, policy space is the issue, right? In other words, you can't go in and make developing countries do what you want them to do, right? But democratically controlled developing countries should have the policy space to make a choice to, for example, not import fertilizers and use their own seeds. Malawi effectively doesn't have that choice right now. I mean, or the choice is constrained. It's not that they can't do it. It's that there's be a huge cost to doing it. They get 40% of their government support from international donors. The largest contributor is USAID. If anybody says, we're pulling out because you're not doing what we want, they have a huge problem. So policy space is huge. And what I found encouraging, and again, to get back to the not being too depressed about all this, the great thing about this trip to Malawi was that even the meetings that I thought I wasn't going to be interested in turned out to be invaluable. I mean, there's just so much interesting stuff going on. And somebody set up a meeting for me with the Millennium Villages Project in southern Malawi. And, you know, it's not as interesting to me to see what you can do with unlimited resources, just because the last thing Malawi has is unlimited resources. On the other hand, they can think outside the box, and they do. But the most interesting thing is that the guy who heads it, Andrew Doughty, was the ag minister for Malawi for 10 years during this whole fight over the fertilizer subsidy program. And when I posed my questions to him, it's like, why hybrid seeds that you have to buy from foreign firms? Why fertilizers when you can't afford it? He said, well, starting this year, we're not recommending that to our Millennium Village projects. We're recommending open pollinated varieties because the risks are lower and the costs are lower. And we're experimenting with ways to stretch fertilizer by mixing it with, if you really want to know, one part fertilizer, two parts chicken manure, and two parts composted corn husks. And their results have been excellent. So short of the organic alternative, the non-chemical alternative, there's ways to stretch, reduce dependence, increase output, and increase independence from outside markets, outside forces. I think that kind of stuff is really, there are really a lot of marginal improvements you can make in agriculture. You know, I end up getting in fights with people on both sides of this. I actually had a really good conversation with the head of the FAO mission in Malawi about this because she felt the same way. Like there's too many dogmatists on both sides of this debate. It's not about being agroecological and organic, and it's not about rejecting agroecology and organic and adopting high-input agriculture. It's about finding ways to marginally reduce your costs and dependence on external inputs that come from scarce resources, and petroleum-based fertilizer is a scarce resource. Sorry, but it is. In the long run, if you're planning for 2050, don't plan on lots of chemical fertilizers. That's not a smart way to go. So if you're looking at marginal improvements and you could reduce, like do what they're going to do at Millennium Villages and reduce your fertilizer dependence to one-fifth of its previous level, that's huge. There's a project in the United States that was kind of buried in the... They took a corn-soy farm, typical corn-soy farm in Iowa, and used it as a control, and did two other farms. One, they introduced a hay crop as a third rotation, and the other, they introduced a hay crop and animals foraging in the field, grazing in the field, and leaving manure in the field. And they found that in both of the experimental cases, with the animals and without, they reduced fertilizer dependence, chemical inputs, by 85% just from that simple rotation, and profitability was the same. So even in the United States, you could do that. But again, where you come up against is the vested interests in agribusiness, who clearly have a certain amount of policy captured, certainly in a place like Malawi, but arguably in a place like Washington, and where where there's, yeah, sort of what's the path from here to there is a, you know, what's the, I mean, that's what you're asking. And I think that's a, I mean, for Malawi, it's an economic crisis. They can't afford their to import. You know, you forget that developing countries that are that poor, you can't import more than you export. You don't have the hard currency from your exports, and you can't import. Monsanto can't import if Malawi doesn't have foreign currency. And they told me they'd lost some markets because they couldn't get the hard currency. Malawi doesn't export much. They're not going to export much. They export tobacco. That market crashed. That's caused the crisis. So reality will impose itself on Malawi's government in the terms of foreign exchange limitations. They've just experienced a devaluation in their currency that drove prices like fuel, electricity, and food prices doubled in the last year in Malawi. Any other country would be rioting. I don't quite know why they're not, but it's dramatic. And that kind of reality, governments face that. They face it at the ballot box. They face it in the fields when they're dealing with farmers. And that forces changes like, yeah, we can't afford to import so much fertilizer. So are there alternatives? Yes. That might be what you see. That's my hope, anyway.
We have reached the end of our time, but I think I speak on everyone's behalf in saying that was an unusually informative hour and 10 minutes or hour and 15 minutes, and a lot of food for thought.
Well, thank you all for coming.
Thank you so much.